Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to a special Simon Says edition of the Queen podcast. We are going to be looking at Smile, etc. today, and we're very excited to do so. But before we get into it, let's introduce the team. So, boom, boom, tsh, it's Suze Kempner, comedian and musician. Hello, Suze.
Hello, thank you for my stomp, stomp clap from just your mouth.
That's right. We have a bum 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 bum. It's Mr. Simon Lupton, documentarian. Hello, Simon.
Hello, and nice to be here again.
Yay. And we also have the mighty comedian and audio superstar. It's Mr. John Robbins.
Hello to you all. Hello, everyone.
And then there's me, Rohan Acharya. There we go. That's the one that I came up with for this episode. But yes, we are doing a Simon Says special. So Simon, do you want to tell us what we're up to this episode?
Yes. So as fond listeners of this podcast will recall, I think in the first episode, we introduced a feature point called Simon Says, that if anyone has any questions about Queen or at any point in their history, then we would attempt to answer them. And we had quite a few, I think probably from newer fans to Queen, perhaps came through the Bohemian Rhapsody movie, who were intrigued about how often we mentioned Smile. And they were keen to know who the hell Smile were, really, and what part they play in the Queen story. So we thought, having just done the first Queen album and mentioned Smile a lot, it would be a good time to delve into a little bit more about who Smile were, the music they did, and the part in Queen history they played.
Nice.
So that's what we're going to do.
That is what we're going to do. So I tell you what, Simon, you're good at this. Why don't you tell us what Smile were?
All right. I'm glad you asked me that, Rohan, because I've been thinking about this a lot recently.
I'm getting slicker by the episode, I tell you.
Okay, so we start in 1964. We have Brian May, age 17, and him and some school friends start a band. And they meet a singer and a harmonica player called Tim Staffel. And he joins them and they decide to call their band 1984 after the George Orwell book because they're all science fiction fans. A year later, Brian heads off to Imperial College to study astronomy. But 1984 continued to play gigs. A particular highlight for them came in 1967 when they supported Jimi Hendrix at an Imperial College gig. With the key moment where, as Brian and 1984 and Tim were sort of hoping to sneak out the front and watch Jimi Hendrix without having to pay to get in, they walked past his dressing room as Jimi Hendrix came out and he just uttered the immortal words, "Where's the stage, man?" to Brian. And,
oh my God, that's so Spinal Tap.
Who pointed him in the right direction and then that was it.
That's amazing. Wow.
So early in 1968, they decided to call it a day. They enjoyed playing, but they didn't feel that they quite had the right stuff to make it. Plus, Brian was getting more and more involved in his studies. However, he kept in touch with Tim, who was at the Ealing College of Art at the time, and they soon realised how much they missed being in a band, so they decided to form another one. They advertised on the Imperial College notice board for a drummer, and the advert was answered by Roger Meadows Taylor. So Roger had been in a band called Johnny Quale and the Reaction, and had become really successful playing the very popular circuit in Devon and Cornwall. I believe there is a book about Queen's exploits in Cornwall.
I'm happy John to provide you with a complimentary copy.
However, Roger knew if he was to succeed in music, then he really needed to be in London. So he enrolled into the London Hospital Medical School to study dentistry, obviously, the well-known, well-trodden path to rock stardom, but with his eye firmly set on finding a band to be in. It was Roger's flatmate who spotted Brian's advert at Imperial College, passed that information on to Roger, who met with Brian and Tim. They jammed at the jazz club room at Imperial College, hit it off immediately, and that was where Smile was born. They became a very well-known band on the college circuit, dividing their time between Imperial College, where they sort of became the resident band, if you like, supporting the likes of Pink Floyd and Yes when they played there. And also they made use of Roger's Cornwall connections to play numerous gigs down there as well. One particular highlight came in February 1969, where they were invited to play at a charity gig at the Royal Albert Hall. They were on the bill with Free, which featured Paul Rodgers, Joe Cocker and the Bonzo Dog Band, with the whole event being hosted by the radio DJ John Peel. So it was a massive gig for them and their first experience of being in front of a really big crowd. And they certainly felt like they were heading in the right direction.
Can I add two quick Roger facts?
Please.
So when this is from an interview with Brian, when Roger answered that ad, that I think asked for, was it a Ginger Baker style drummer?
Ginger Baker, Mitch Mitchell style drummer.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Brian said what impressed him about Roger in the audition, which I think was at Imperial College in a sort of a hall, was firstly that he tuned his drums. Before that, he started the audition, and secondly, that when he hit the, I think it's when he hit the snares, he would hit the cymbals at the same time,
yeah,
which gives him a much bigger sound. So as opposed to sort of playing a a fill on the actual physical drums and then hitting a few cymbals. He would do both at the same time. And I think it's also worth pointing out that when we say, you know, they supported Jimi Hendrix and Free, that's a very different, and Pink Floyd, that's very different to the situation today. So if you supported Pink Floyd today, that would mean you were quite a big band playing big venues. But back then, because bands tended to only play sort of theatres and music hall venues and corn exchanges and stuff, the local band was just sort of used to, so it doesn't mean they were suddenly massive because they were supporting bands that we now see as being huge sort of monolithic rock bands. It was sort of a much more bespoke local kind of vibe, wasn't it?
Absolutely. This is sort of an era before stadium rock, I guess.
Yeah, oh, completely. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a sort of a case of that's what the college scene was like. You were able to rub shoulders with the likes of Pink Floyd and Jimi Hendrix and they're at the beginning of their journey as well. But they'd obviously sort of got a bit further down the line.
They weren't the huge megastars that they are now, and that sort of probably happened after stadium rock became more, and when rock became much more sort of financially rewarding, that suddenly the distance between audience and artist became immeasurable. You know, the idea that you would sort of go to a Madonna concert today and see her in the bar afterwards is just like completely and utterly unthinkable. But even in the 70s, you would sort of have much more access to the physical members of the band than you do now.
There's footage on the YouTubes of that Royal Albert Hall gig with Smile. Alas, absolutely no sound, but you can see I think it's 6 or 7 minutes of fuzzy black and white footage of Smile going at it and Roger looking cool as all heck.
I wonder if there is sound somewhere. Someone's got the audio.
Simon, have you got it?
No, I've never heard the audio for it. I have a feeling, and I may be wrong about this, that the film was actually shot by Douglas Puddifoot, who was a photographer as well as a cameraman. And famously, from a Queen point of view, he did all the photographs that appear on the back cover of the first Queen album. So that photo shoot was, and he sort of photographed the band a lot at that time. I think he was a friend of Roger's.
Right.
So if that is the case, and he's listening, maybe he could let us know if he's got the audio, because that would be amazing. So yes, so picking up the story.
Thank you.
It was at this point that Mercury Records started to show an interest and actually gave the band a record deal. And they went into Trident Studios and started to record some songs. And it was also about this time that a friend of Tim's started to hang out with the band, a chap called Freddie Balsara. He was a very keen supporter of Smile and had plenty of ideas about how they should present themselves on stage and was very forthcoming in sharing his views, we're told. He'd often travel with them in their van to gigs. In August in 1969, Mercury Records released two of Smile's songs. The first one was Earth, which was the A side, and on the B side was Step On Me, which Step On Me had started life as a 1984 song. The single failed to do anything at all, which was a big disappointment to the band and to Mercury Records as well. Smile went back into the studio, this time to Delane Lee, to record some more songs. Interestingly, one of those songs was April Lady, which wasn't actually written by them, and had Brian on lead vocals. The band were very happy with the results, but Mercury's belief in them had started to waver, it would seem, and none of it was actually ever released. By the end of 1969, they played a gig at the very prestigious Marquee Club, which was a kind of showcase arranged by the record label. But the crowd was quite small and not particularly interested, so I don't think it went very well. Despite these setbacks, Brian and Roger remained ambitious, determined and optimistic, and were strong believers that the new decade would bring the break that they desperately needed. Unfortunately, Tim had kind of had enough of slogging around the college circuit and was running out of patience, and he was given the chance to join a band fronted by Colin Peterson, who was the ex-drummer of the Bee Gees, called Humpy Bong. And he made the switch, or as Roger has described in an interview, Tim sodded off to Humpy Bong. They soon released a single, which was called Don't You Believe, which made it onto Top of the Pops, but it faltered after that, and eventually Tim drifted out of the music business altogether. Oh. So with Tim leaving, Mercury Records took the opportunity to drop Smile. Brian and Roger, I think you could have forgiven them for throwing in the towel at this point, but they were not to be deterred and vowed to carry on. All they needed was a new singer.
Dun, dun, dun!
Yeah. So who did they get? So it just seems like a weird place to
podcast.
End.
I think it's a fascinating story, but you can, when we listen to the music, you can definitely hear the beginnings of Queen in there, can't you? But I love the similarities with the Queen story. I love the fact that the two studios that Smile used were Trident and Delane Lee, which is where the Queen story started as well. So it was almost like the false start for Queen, really.
I think people probably who are hearing about Smile maybe for the first time, if they've come to Queen late, will find it really interesting to go back. But when I first heard Smile, I would say it was probably my third or fourth Queen album was Smile.
Oh, wow.
Because I'd definitely got by that time Greatest Hits 2, Queen 1, and maybe Sheer Heart Attack. And a friend of my mum's who was really into Queen, especially early Queen, now he actually gave me a tape, and on one side was Queen 1, on the other side was Smile. And it was sort of the same sort of EP that is on a lot of different, it's called a lot of different things. I think it's called like Queen in Neuse was when it was first out. And the album was Gettin' Smile, wasn't it?
That's the one I got. I got a Japanese import of that.
Yeah.
Which was sort of one of the last things I got.
So that's it. Simon's holding it up. So I had a cassette copy of that. So that music was for me much more like part of Queen, because I knew this was sort of what Queen were called before they were Queen. But at the end of that collection of Smile songs was a song which I, for nearly 30 years now, I've tried to track down, and I could only like sing it to myself, this Smile song, and I couldn't find it on any listings or whatever, or any Wikipedia pages, any forums. And this week I was trying to find it to be like, because this is my favourite Smile song and I want to share it with everyone on the podcast. And the only lyric I could remember was, say it ain't so, Joe, please say it ain't so. So I was Googling. It turns out the only version I could find of it was by a guy called Lachlan Murray or something.
Oh, that's a name that rings a bell for someone.
Murray Head, sorry.
All right.
And I thought, oh, so Smile must have covered this song by Murray Head. So I found it on YouTube and I played it, and it was exactly, I was like, oh, wow, this has taken me right back. It's my favourite Smile song. I realised that this guy had just added an extra track to the end of the Smile. So the song's called Say It Ain't So. And it's by Murray Head. It was released in 1975, so it's got nothing to do with Smile. So for 30 years... I thought that this great lost Smile song. The amazing thing is, it sounds a hell of a lot like Tim Staffel, and it sort of fits with their stuff.
Wow, so this podcast isn't just helping our listeners, it's very much helping.
Yes, help me solve an age-old problem with my favourite Smile song not being by Smile.
Oh, wow, that is absolute gold. That is absolute gold. Fantastic. So that is an interesting point. Suze, when did you first encounter Smile?
When I was about 17, I bought Queen in Neuse in HMV, that big one on, it's still there, isn't it, on Bond Street.
Yeah.
I remember I'd go in there and go through, see what was available by Queen. There were usually 5 or 6 albums available and always the greatest hits. And if they had one that I didn't have, I'd buy it. And I bought Queen in Neuse, and it had no info in it, and similarly to John, I just thought, well, this is Queen before Queen, but I had no idea who this Tim Staffel was. It's only late that I learned about him. But I have a link to Smile, a tiny link, but it brings it all together beautifully.
Seven Degrees of Rye?
It is a little bit.
Is it?
I don't know if it counts. I don't know if it counts. In 2011, friends of mine were doing an Amdram production of We Will Rock You, and they were doing it at Imperial in that hall where Smile played. So,
They didn't pay for the rights.
No, they put it on as a charity thing, so they had 24 hours to rehearse it, and then they did one performance.
How did it go?
It was very charming.
Was the lighting superb?
It was lovely and charming. It was for charity. It was a load
of
sort of biology students and putting on. Yeah, they'd done their best.
That's amazing. I'm going to ask you in a second, Simon, as well. But yeah, I used to go to Books, Bits and Bobs in Kingston. I think you're talking about the big HMV on Oxford Street, right? So I used to go to this crazy little shop in Kingston. They used to sell like everything, comics and albums and stuff. And I was looking through the Queen section and suddenly saw this crazy Japanese import LP of Smile with, and I was like, what is this? And I actually had to ask them, and they were like, yeah, that's the band before Queen. And I was like looking in the back going, oh my god, and it took me months to save up for that thing. Finally got it, and I am pretty sure that my mother's got rid of it in a jumble sale on the rare occasions where I bring my, you know, build up the courage to go see her. I sort of have a surreptitious look, but I think she's got rid of all the LPs. And I was just looking at how much it might cost to replace it on eBay this week, and it's £300.
Oh my god.
Someone's lucky in the car boot sale.
I'm hoping that she doesn't have too long left, and then when I'm going through her house, having to clear it all out, maybe it will turn up.
Behind
I wonder
something.
If people got into Queen in the early 90s, if they had the experience where they got to Smile quite early because the Queen in New CD was cheaper than all the Queen CDs.
Yeah.
So I first got all the Queen albums on cassette, and then started buying them all on CD.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were new to CDs when you were young and still didn't have a lot of disposable income, you would always buy the $6.99 ones before the $14.99 ones.
Yeah.
And Queen in Nice was always $6.99, and so was do you remember the Interview collection?
Yes. I had that as well. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's four CDs with each of the band member on a different CD,
yes.
And they were like $6.99 each. So you could afford them much more quickly than you could like Live at Wembley double CD would probably be $22.99.
You've just given me a moment where I can actually smell the hour price in Wimbledon.
Yeah.
I really liked that Queen in New CD.
What
as well,
is it?
Right?
I never encountered it. What's on it? What is it? A bootleg thing?
Like John said, it's that same collection that appears under various different names. It's got on it, it had Larry Lurex on it, and it's got like Smile, it's got By Smile, April Lady, Earth, Polar Bear, Step On Me, which I think is amazing. It didn't have a version of Doing All Right on there.
It did have Black on it. Earth, and then
you've got it there, and I'm trying to let go. It's got this on it, I believe.
Yeah. You're doing really well. Keep going.
What have I missed?
Who would have owned that music, Simon, at the time? Because that's not an official Queen release, is it?
This is released by a company called Milestone Records. So I can only imagine.
So there's an early Van Morrison album, which is sort of pre-Astral Week stuff, which is released by about 10 different record labels. Is this a similar thing in that it's essentially copyright-free music that you can put out wherever?
I think that's what it's got to be. I think there must be sort of up for grabs as to who owns it. And I suspect that Doing All Right got claimed by Queen because they redid it as a Queen track. But the rest are up for grabs. Because when you look at Queen in News, if you get it, the photograph is on the front is not great. There's nothing inside the booklet. That's blank.
No.
Randomly on the CD is a photograph of Freddie from the... it's a Hard Life video, so quite what that's got to do with anything.
It's bizarre,
I have no
isn't
idea.
It?
But yeah, as you say, it was it's a way of getting that music, I guess.
Have any of you solved the riddle of why it's called Queen in Use?
No. I don't know what that even means.
Sorry, Giles, producer Giles.
With apologies to our Italian audience and listeners, in nuce means in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Oh, does it? Oh, I never knew that. So it's nuce, and I began Queenie News.
Wow, the things we're solving on this podcast. 30-year-old itches. So it's nuce, it's Italian.
We've been calling it in nuce for 20, 30 years. Brilliant.
He still doesn't describe it very well.
Yeah, we couldn't pick a worse title for an unofficial collection of pre-Queen songs that weren't written or recorded by Queen with nothing in the liner notes and a photo of a member who wasn't even in the band to describe Queen in a nutshell.
How many times did you look at that cover and go, Queen in useless, more like? And then now, 30 years later. It's thank you, producer odd. Charles.
Nuce.
Oh, there you go.
It reminds me of the guitarist from my school band who had an epiphany one day when he offered me some Meringue ice cream and I went, you mean meringue?
Meringue!
He thought meringue and Meringue were two different things. And it was beautiful
moment. Wait until we get to a special Queen lyric mishearings episode that we'll have to do at some
point. Yeah, cool. That's a genius idea. That's going down in the notes. Shout out to Zoe. Bless you. Miss you. Right. How do we feel? Oh, Simon, yes. How did you get into... When did you first encounter Smile? Was what part of your...
Well, it was actually the album called Queen in Nuce. Was what got me into it.
Fantastic release.
It was that kind of thing where I had bought all the albums, but like you, I'd sort of go into HMV in London in the hope that there might be something, and I discovered this as a new release, and wonderfully it was cheaper as well, as John said. Yeah. So it was like a win-win. And you do come away and you get a bit disappointed because it's not actually Queen at all. It's the members of Queen, but in different forms. It was sort of when Jackie and Jim brought out their Queen as It Began book.
The fan club.
And it was the complete story of Queen, and then they really sort of explained what Smile was, in a really brilliant way, which was great.
Something that we will come back to again and again is that there is so little compared to other bands that doesn't come through the official sort of release channels. So in terms of rarities and bootlegs and crazy albums that you'd never seen before, there isn't a lot with Queen, whereas other bands people might be fans of, you can get almost as many sort of rarities and little sort of nuggets and Easter eggs as you do official albums. Certainly if you're like a Beatles or a Bob Dylan fan, there's whole sort of swathes of unreleased stuff and interesting little tidbits. But with Queen, they're much more careful about what makes it out of the sort of the I don't know what the phrase is,
the
mothership.
Their oeuvre.
The
mothership.
I've got one question about buying stuff in shops like HMV. Am I the only one that knew that Queensryche existed because they were next to Queen?
Yes.
Same.
Otherwise I'd have no idea that they ever existed.
And Queens of the Stone Age and Queens of the movie. And you'd go through and you go, oh, is that something new? No, it's Queens of the Stone Age, and they've put it back in the wrong place.
You'll get really disappointed. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, we probably sort of listened to a surprising amount of material from those two bands just to double check that they're not Queen. I certainly did explore quite a bit of Queen of the Stone Age in the end. But I was angry with anything that wasn't Queen. When you go through anything, I was like, Prince, angry with you, you're not Queen. I'm so militantly loyal to Queen that the very labels of other bands would upset me.
Well, luckily Mercury Rev are actually very good.
Oh yeah, that's true. That's true. For what they do. All right, brilliant. Should we actually listen to some of this stuff? What do you think? Let's listen to the first track on the album, which is called Earth. I think this one was written by Tim. It's just under 4 minutes long, 3 minutes 59. It was produced by John Anthony, who did go on to work on quite a bit of Queen stuff, right, guys? I'm being presented with the most fabulous yawn from John right now. And and apparently he wrote it because he was a bit of a science fiction, but I think they were all science fiction buffs really, but it was a reaction to that, and recorded in June 1969, as are the rest of the tracks we're going to listen to. So I'm going to just play this little bit here.
I might be at a table and suddenly I'll catch a fleeting vision of her crystal seas. Or I might be standing in a crowded dockyard far away, underneath the sun I've never seen. Cause I have seen
about that.
Really good.
I often think, like, when I first knew of Smile, it was always like, oh, what if Tim Staffel had gone on to being Queen, which obviously would never have happened because so much of Queen is Freddie's input. But I think it would be interesting if he'd been the bass player.
Because, did he play bass?
Yeah, so he was lead vocals and bass, and that's a much more likely possibility that Queen could have featured Freddie on vocals and Tim on sort of backing vocals and bass, because his bass playing is actually really nice. It's quite interesting in the background. I mean, I'm still Deacon Till I Die. Hashtag Deacon Till I Die.
Yeah, I was quietly seething, to be honest.
Just the little bit, the little runs he does. I'm not saying they're Deacon-esque, but they do bring something a bit more to it than just sort of a classic background bass.
Yeah, it does drive. His bass does drive through that song. It's beautiful. It's a very beautiful song, and actually he has got a very beautiful voice. He really does.
He's got a great voice. It's so different to Freddie's. It's really interesting hearing. They did a version of Doing All Right following the movie. It's his voice in the movie as well, isn't it, in Bohemian Rhapsody? It's called Doing All Right Revisited with him, Brian and Roger. And hearing their different voices sing Doing All Right when I'm so used to hearing Freddie sing it is really interesting. Their approaches were completely different.
He's mellifluous, isn't he? He's just sort of, there's an ease to it, and it's really impressive, I think.
It's an interesting question, isn't it, as to whether they would have been successful if they'd stuck at it, you know, carried Smile on, because Roger and Brian are such integral parts of Queen's success. So you'd like to think that they would have been successful in whatever form they moved forward. And I think we all probably agree they wouldn't have been as big as Queen became, because whether you put aside comparing Tim as a performer and a vocalist, you if you take out Freddie's composition from Queen, there's a huge chunk missing, because, you know, Freddie had a habit of writing songs at really key moments, like, you know, Killer Queen was their first real big hit, and that was Freddie, and Bohemian Rhapsody was Freddie. So, you know, Freddie played a massive part in Queen becoming as big as they did. But I've got a feeling they would have done pretty well. I think there were a lot of bands that did succeed in the 70s that were a lot worse than Smile.
Oh yeah.
And I appreciate that this is, you know, an early recording and all this kind of stuff, but actually the nature of the music just reminds me very faintly, you know, the bit in Spinal Tap where you see their pre-Spinal Tap band and it's all in black and white, they've got like bowl haircuts and stuff, and you know, it just has a, that's it, the Quarrymen. It just has a little, I think it's fair that this is a blueprint for what Queen became.
It sounds more like music from a 60s band who never quite made it, as opposed to music that you can listen to and think, oh, I can absolutely tell why they went on to be enormous. I bet everyone was in a band like Smile.
Yeah. It's a little bit, particularly this song, particularly Earth, is a little bit Space Oddity, isn't it? I suppose that they were parallel because that's 1969 as well, I think. But yeah, it's definitely 60s themes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I do take your point, Simon. I think it is surprisingly good for that type of album that you might listen to now, and you're like, actually, this is pretty credible stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Also, in Brian's guitar parts, you can absolutely see that he was going to go on to be someone who could write incredibly melodically and not sort of take over a song. And I love the guitar tone. I mean this in the nicest way. It's got a really nice squawk about it, which you can also pick up on in Queen 1. I mean, by Queen 2, it was much more sort of, I guess the word would be like regal and harmonised, but there's a really nice, it sounds like one guitar, but a very full, if squawky, version of said guitar.
Yeah, and lovely. If you listen to, I don't know if we can listen to a bit of Blag. I don't know if you've got that to hand.
Do you want to go straight to Blag? I was just going to work through, but we can go straight to Blag.
Oh, okay.
Right,
well,
now,
just with Blag, it just sort of ties into what John was saying there, is that you can very much hear the beginning of Brighton Rock, can't you?
Talk about that when we get to that? Because that is, I'm actually going to play that bit that you're talking about. Oh. So what I've done is made you look incredibly prescient.
Yes, I'm a bit ahead of the curve, so I'll wait for everyone else to catch up.
Or we could, I think it'd just be easier to work through. Shall we listen to the next track on the album, which is "Step on Me," which Brian and Tim wrote together. So it's credited to May and Staffel. It's just over 3 minutes, 3 minutes and nine, and it goes a little bit like this. Know what I said when I saw you crying. Hang on, that's for me. I was speaking ahead, I believed you're lying. You're just a bad memory. My life is going to be better. Ooh. My wife, can I never, ever see she step on.
I've never seen the lyrics before. I thought it was, my life was going to be better. My wife. Could I thought it was my wife.
That's going to be.
Now I know it's my why. I thought it was my wife. Could I never see she'd step on me?
The song about a guy with a really tall wife.
Yeah. Hey. She stepped on me.
It's why I went for that second verse, actually, because there's this constant reference to smile. And I think they kind of had a whole branding thing. There's that photo of them holding little smiles up. I think Tim designed that smile logo and all that kind of stuff.
Ah, cool.
And it's interesting that they're referring to themselves in a way. There's a play on the lyrics here. And that reminds me of Queen's lyrical play, where they refer to themselves in person or whatever. And, you know, that's something that they definitely kept doing.
Yeah.
What a fascinating observation I've just made.
No, but it is like Queen, because then Freddie went on to design the Queen logo, so it's weird parallels.
Yeah. What a tune, though. It's a proper tune. Yeah. It's just a really jolly, listenable, fabulous tune.
It's quite Beatles, isn't it?
Yeah.
Also, it's probably the only time you'll hear Brian May without the Deaky amp. So John Deacon made it's not a treble booster. I think, did he make the treble booster as well? Anyway, John Deacon made a preamp for Brian called which became known as the Deaky amp. People may email in to say it's not technically a preamp. Anyway, it's called the Deaky Amp, and it plays a big part in Brian's sound. He still uses it to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been sort of, you can buy official versions of it, I think they did manufacture it. I watched a 50-minute interview with Brian about his guitar and effects a couple of days ago, which was very interesting. And I'm guessing so it sounds like when you listen to the guitar on Step On Me that he's using a fuzz pedal. I very much doubt he was, but you can also tell he wasn't using a Vox AC30 absolutely up to the max, because he stopped using, or doesn't use overdrive, because the Voxes, when you turn them up really high, do a better version of it than an overdrive pedal would do. Just the natural sound of the Voxes. Which is also why I was listening to a podcast about the Beatles the other day called My Own Personal Beatles that a friend of mine started. So when the Beatles played Shea Stadium, they had Vox AC30s, but because the sound setup there was hilariously bad, the amps weren't even mic'd up. They turned all the amps up as high as they could go, so the songs just sound much heavier than they usually would, because the amps are up higher than the Beatles would ever have used them in the studio.
Okay.
So you get a much heavier sound on those live Beatles gigs than you would usually do. And I think there you've got Brian perhaps slightly turned down, but that's just a guess.
So you're telling me that Brian got his dad to make him a guitar, got his bass player to make him an amp. Did Brian ever go to a shop? Did he ever go buy anything?
He did. Well, A, he got the Royal Mint to make his plectrum.
That's true.
But also he bought the only thing that he couldn't fully make himself were the pickups. He tried making pickups, but because the body of the Red Special is slightly hollow, it's got two sort of acoustic boxes in it. When you put, and I'm basically reporting this knowledge from Brian himself because he says it in the interview, but right, when you mic up an acoustic guitar with just a regular pickup, you get feedback between the acoustic sound of the guitar and the signal going into the pickup, a bit like the reason we're all on our headphones for this interview,
okay,
is because if we didn't, we would be getting the feedback from the various signals. So he couldn't make his own one to avoid that whistling and feedback problem. So he went to the Burns shop on Tottenham Court Road and said, "Do you have any pickups?" And they said, "Yeah, we got these." And I think they were 9 guineas.
Wow. How much
Keynesian language,
so,
isn't it?
So he bought them, and then he filled them with araldite to stop the feedback problem. And they're still on his guitar today.
That is amazing. I don't think the guy...
It's amazing that it's the same guitar, and it's not even like, what is it, Trigger's broom. It's like, oh, it's had 19 new handles and 8 new heads. It sounds like the Red Special hasn't had anything new or anything. It just...
It had a star. So I've got a Red Special copy. But I've got the second release of the Guild copies, which, you know, as a purist, you can say is one of the more beautiful versions, but certainly not as good as the very specific bespoke ones he got made more recently.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a little star, you know, the star from Back to the Light and Another World.
Oh, yeah.
There's a star on the... on the scratch plate, and that is to cover a button for a fuzz switch, which he may have been using on that Smile track, actually, putting two and two together, which he then removed when he realised you could get the better effect by turning the AC30s up to the maximum, and that completes my anecdote.
Incredible. Well, my main concern is we only have purists left listening at this point, so should we move on to the next track and try and get some of our mainstream listeners. Well, that is amazing, John. That detail of
knowledge—that's wicked.
It's really great. That's. I'll translate that one day and understand what you mean. I'll like probably listen back. No, that was fantastic. Well, we're moving on to the track that they did take onto Queen One. Written by May and Staffel, 3 minutes 45. It is Doing All Right Time, which is a kind of different version of this. I'm going to play a bit from about halfway through the track. You can kind of see how they evolved the track for Queen One.
Should be waiting for the sun. Anyway, I got too high.
What a blueprint of the songs that's come. You know, it's like almost like a work in progress, isn't it? When you get to the Queen version, there's a few extra bars of guitar for sure, and just such a huge, amazing sound. And like you're saying, Simon, they're in exactly the same studio as they were in. And I think from what John was saying, they had different equipment at the time, though.
He's certainly got a very Robert Plant vibe to his voice there, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Like, really noticeably Planty.
It's just completely different to Freddie. For that, because when Freddie sings that, Should Be Waiting for the Sun, on the Queen One album, he's got a much more relaxed tone. And it's not even quite falsetto, but it's like a very... I mean, I don't know, I haven't seen him sing it, but I imagine he's using a very wide mouth shape to create that. Whereas Tim Staffel's, the sound's much further back, and it's, again, not falsetto, but he'll suddenly flip into falsetto. So he's like, it's quite a should be waiting for the sky to clear. And it's, he'll like very noticeably flip into falsetto, whereas Freddie doesn't really do that, which is not a disservice to either of them. It's a choice, but yeah, like such different sung approaches to the same bit.
See, John, that's how you make a point without losing just the general.
Yeah, but Tim Staffel,
technical analysis.
Tim Staffel doesn't have a little star on his vocal cords where he used to have a fuzz box because his dad made his throat.
I would be interested for listener feedback if they're like, could you stop being a nerd about different ways singers tilt their vocal folds, please?
You must keep
it's I'm fascinated by it. It's really nice to have these two different vocals for the same song.
There's that moment. The reason I picked that moment is on the Queen version, you get that amazing moment of Freddie going, wide away, that amazing.
And it doesn't even sound like a flip into Bell. He's like, anyway, I got to hide away. And he's got all that amazing Freddie distortion on it from the start.
Yeah, there's a sort of ferocity to the way Freddie's doing it, whereas Tim's actually saying it's a very beautiful version of the song, actually. I think Tim's vocal's very rich. What do you think, Simon? Where do you stand on the two versions of Doing All Right?
No, it goes back to what we were saying, doesn't it? It's the blueprint. You know, you can see you know, everyone sort of finding their way and finding their sound, as you say. And that's why Smile is such an important part of the Queen story, because so much of the foundations were being laid, not only by Brian and Roger in what they were doing and how they were developing the styles, but Freddie watching them and seeing them and going, okay, if I was their lead singer, this is what I'd be doing. You know, he was learning from Tim, you know, perhaps what he would do more than Tim, but it just sort of meant that when Smile then merged into Queen, it did with that confidence, because Smile had existed beforehand.
And it's actually,
and I
Tim
think doing all right is such a great way of comparing that journey.
Yeah. Yeah, and I imagine that he would be telling the band that this is how I would do it as well. But it is actually Tim, because it was Tim who was at Ealing Art College with Freddie, and so he's the one that introduced them to the band. It's actually
So Freddie was Tim's friend, and they must have met, I'm sure, because they were both at Ealing Art College. It's sort of why Freddie was such the perfect fit, because so much of what Tim was bringing to the band in terms of his design and that kind of artistic look, you know, Freddie took and then took to the next level and beyond. It's interesting. It's quite sad, because whenever you hear Tim interviewed, he sort of kind of says, oh, yeah, everyone, Queen fans need to thank me, because if I hadn't moved out of the way, you wouldn't have had Queen, which feels quite sad. But I think, you know, it's lovely that we're here being able to sort of acknowledge the role that he played in helping sort of create it.
And I think there's an enormous amount of affection for Tim amongst the Queen fan community, right?
Queen fans never tire of, you know, hearing what he has to say and reminiscing about those days, for sure.
So for the next track we're going to listen to is April Lady, which was written by the mysterious Stanley Lucas, who we have no real idea who he is or where he came from. We think that he may have been just a sort of in-house writer for the label, actually. And we're moving into a bunch of tracks that are produced by Fritz Freier now. It's a short song. It's 2 minutes 42, and I'm just going to play a blast of that now.
The children learn to read. She strung their beads, but sorry she was the one. As you can see, isn't she good? She don't leave nothing undone. Goodbye, April Lady. It's been good to have you around. Goodbye, April Lady. It's our
That's a good rock and roll song, isn't it?
I think it sounds perhaps the most Queen of any of the Smile tracks. And because you've got that harmony and there's that really nice chord sequence there just before that cut out.
That's all beat.
Yeah, I would like to have heard Queen's version of April Lady the most, probably.
Yeah.
Yes, that would be great.
Yeah, there's little hints of Sweet Lady in that as well, isn't there? But it is a beautiful, beautiful progression. So this is a Roger Taylor track we're going to listen to now, called Blag, which is just over 3 minutes long. And this is the only Roger song on this album, which is so he started that tradition here.
Sunshine, you take away my rain.
That's a soaring rocker, isn't it? There's the sort of the doo-doo-doo bits on either side of it that I'm maybe less enamoured with, but that centre section is just blinding rock with Tim just belting out as actually pretty much as hard as Freddie could.
But in a completely different place, yeah.
I think maybe he was sort of dallying with the limits of his vocal range a bit more than Freddie would perhaps have done. Only just, you can just sort of hear him at the top of what he could do there, I think.
He does slightly lose it in the odd millisecond here and there, doesn't he?
But it doesn't really matter because of the nature of the song is quite sort of rough and ready. And I don't know if any of you noticed, certainly I noticed it, you might have not picked up on this, but every single hit of the snare drum is accompanied by a simultaneous hit on the cymbal, and that's just the sort of thing that...
That
really sort of high-level musos like myself pick up on and have not just been told by the producer at all.
But it is exactly what you mentioned Brian had picked up on about Roger's playing.
You can hear that Roger hyperactivity that is often there in especially his early penned Queen tracks. There's like this real energy to them.
Definitely. And just that's the beginning of the Queen sound, you know, which I think that particular moment lends itself to is really reminiscent of Brighton Rock, you know, that kind of the way the guitar and the drums are playing off of each other.
Mm. It's so weird to hear it without the delay, though.
Yes.
So you're essentially hearing one third, because he would have had two. So he had like ping pong delay. So to go diddlin, 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 diddlin. So it's weird to hear basically half of. You're hearing one speaker from Brighton Rock.
I love that he's been noodling with that sort of sequence of ideas and is still doing that in his solos live. He still uses that as the base place for where he's going to launch off into. So that's something that he's had around since, 1969. So I guess that's sort of the stuff that he was playing around with as a kid growing up. Because you said he was, 17 at this point? No, a bit older. 19, 20 maybe?
Yeah, he was 20s. At university at this point, but college, you know, Imperial College. But yeah, no, it's something that stayed with him his entire career and it is what makes him unique. You know, that's the Brian May sound. You know, you can hear it coming together there.
So Polar Bear. For the sake of completion, here is a little bit of Polar Bear by Tim Staffell and Brian May. Here we go.
Sharp window sits a polar bear, makes the children's eyes light up to see him there.
Polar Bear. Any response to Polar Bear from the gang?
I got a tone of it.
It's just so Robert Plant. His vocal is so Led Zepp. It's almost like you kind... I don't know, people are often accused early Queen of being very Led Zepp, but that is too Led Zepp for me. and I like Led Zepp.
Yeah.
I just remember when I first got that Smile album, being really excited about there being a song called Polar Bear. And then it was, I think it might have been the first one I put, I was like, I've got to listen to that one first. And it is, for me personally, with my tastes, which are very mainstream, more of a challenging listen than I think the rest of the stuff on the album. I actually really like this album, but less so for me, that one particularly. But that's all right. How do we feel about just quickly checking out these bits of Freddy that I've got available?
Is it the last lyrics?
Yeah, so I thought the first thing that I'll play is just a little bit of this. It's a terrible recording of an Ibex gig, which was the Liverpool, was it Manchester band that Freddie was a part of, that then he renamed Wreckage. I'll get onto that in a second. But this is from the Liverpool Sync Club in September 1969. And it's the last Ibex gig, which was recorded by Jeff Higgins, their roadie. Smile were at the gig. Brian and Roger joined the band, including Freddie, on stage for the first time. However, Higgins' tape ran out before that bit actually happened. So this is the gig where the guys sort of first essentially played together, which is quite cool. And this is a track called Rain. I hope you can even... I don't know, let's see. About six or seven tracks of that, lasts about half an hour, and what blows my mind is I mean, to be fair, I guess it was only put up in May this year, but there's genuinely only 41 views of that so far. So with any luck after this podcast that might actually go up a bit, but what do you think, Simon?
It's fascinating to hear, isn't it? You can definitely tell it's Freddie.
Oh yeah,
yes,
that's the thing. And I think it's fair to say he took a little while to find his voice, you know, and but it's really strong from that, and that's what, 1969. So
yeah, so he was very young, right?
Yeah,
22
with no formal training or anything. That's
and he's going for it, you know, that you can hear him so clearly through all the racket. I think the tape recorder was next to the bass amp, so. Right. That's why you hear the bass so strong in it and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, Fred's cutting through that somehow. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So that is a beautiful artifact. And then, of course, there's that brilliant story of how he changed Ibex's name to Wreckage by speaking to each individual member of the band and telling them that the rest of the band had agreed to change the name to Wreckage, right? Which is fantastic. He's so mischievous. I love him. But this was recorded in his flat, and they were being purposefully quiet because neighbours were complaining about them making a racket and stuff.
Oh, wasn't it like 1 a.m. or something?
Yeah, exactly.
We've got to rehearse. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is very, very quiet. Freddie particularly is quiet. But anyway, let's listen to a little bit of it because it's a beautiful art about it.
Don't forget, but when you, after the two verses, he'd be doing the same thing like you did. Like he'd be going,
Okay, look, let's get on with these. Start, right?
Freddie's earlier band. Very jolly little number it is too.
Yeah.
What I love about it is you can hear from that. Freddie's one of the only singers I've ever heard, certainly one of the only male singers I've ever heard, who can have a real light tone but keep it really full. One of the only other singers I can compare it to is Barbara Streisand, who can actually barely make a noise into the mic, and yet it's a real full, rich sound. And he's marking there, basically, but
Freddie would have loved to hear you say, oh, he's the only person I can think of that he sounds like is Barbara Streisand. Freddie would have...
The example I can think of with Barbara Streisand is the ending of a song she did in Yentl called A Piece of Sky. And at the end of A Piece of Sky, she holds for about 24 seconds a belted D. but she's literally making barely a noise into the mic in the recording, but it sounds like a whole thing. And it's not just the mic doing the work. And Freddie there, it's even more impressive because it's being recorded on a tape recorder.
Wow. That's a beautiful, beautiful thing to be able to discern from a fuzzy recording in Freddie's flat. But that's beautiful. That's absolutely beautiful. I thought there's three other tracks that I think that are prescient for this album, for this podcast, this episode, that is worth looking at very quickly. It's the double A-side by Larry Lurex, which I think he and Brian and Roger write. So I mean, maybe you could tell us a bit about Larry Lurex.
Well, from what I can recall, yes, it was when they were in the studio, but they wanted someone to test the equipment, and they asked if Brian, Roger and Freddie would just to play these tracks, and they ended up recording them. And I think it wasn't until much later, when Queen started to take off, that they got released as Larry Lurex, which was a play on Gary Glitter, who was very big at the time, less so now, we're all pleased to report.
That's very delicately handled.
Strap in for this, guys. Do you want to hear a Queen and Gary Glitter fact?
Go on.
Yes.
Okay, we'll ask you a question. When was Queen's last live performance with John Deacon?
Oh, no. Well, I'm going to
talk about the after-show party.
Yes.
So not at the Freddie Mercury tribute, then?
No, as in Freddie's last, Queen's last performance.
Oh, so not Nebworth.
No, it was at Kensington Roof Gardens.
Oh, of course.
At the after-show party with Gary Glitter.
Oh, shit.
So technically, because they all got on stage, and I think they did the sort of rock and roll medley, didn't they?
Yeah.
Okay.
I once did a corporate for a magazine company that was taking place underneath Kensington Roof Gardens, and they were having their after party on Kensington Roof Gardens, and I, for some reason, before I handed out the awards to Best Knitting magazine, decided to mention that this was actually a pretty important venue for me, because it's technically where Queen's last performance with Gary Glitter was. Not a huge amount of take up for that factoid there.
Wow. This was they were recording their debut album at Trident Studio, the Trident Studios house engineer Robin Jeffrey Cable got Freddie to perform lead vocals on some tracks he was experimenting with, and Freddie performed as Larry Lurex. And these were released in 1973 on the I Can Hear Music single. And this was released actually a couple of weeks before the Keep Yourself Alive single was released. So I'll play the A side, which is I Can Hear Music, which was a Phil Spector song, essentially. Phil Spector, Ellie Greenwich, and Jeff Barry. And I'll play this first. I can hear music. I can hear music. Sound There's a sort of spoofiness to it, isn't there?
Yeah,
there's certainly a sense of humour to it.
I mean, far be it from me to suggest another appalling collaboration with another appalling person, but you can't help but think if Freddie and Phil Spector together at their peaks, what a wall of sound that would have been.
What's interesting on that is Brian and Roger were also playing on that track. But they weren't playing.
You can hear that guitar.
You can, yeah. It's almost Christmassy somehow, that track, isn't it?
It is. Mm. Well, Phil Spector had that Christmas album, didn't he? But the wall of sound technique, recording technique, Freddie was obviously really interested in that because you hear it on Queen 2 in Funny How Love Is. Those two really complement each other.
That's true.
But the guitar solo in that reminds me so much of I'm Going Slightly Mad.
The guitar solo in this track?
In I Can Hear Music.
In I Can Hear Music.
They've, like, nearly 20 years apart, they really sound, it really sounds influenced by this guitar solo.
So this is the B-side on that single called Going Back, which was written by Jerry Goffin and Carole King, the famous Carole King, of course. This only features Freddie. It doesn't have any other Queen participants on it. The final line of Mother Love, which is that the last track on the Made in Heaven album, sort of, before that?
It's the last track they ever recorded in the studio. Right? It's the last ever Freddie vocal.
And the line that song ends on, Mother Love ends on, is I think I'm going back to the things I learned so well in my youth. And this is I'm Going Back. I can recall a time when I wasn't ashamed to reach out to a friend. And now I think I've got a lot more than just my toys to lend. Now there's more to do than watch my sailboat ride. And every day can be my magic carpet ride. And I can play hide and seek with my fears and live my days instead of counting my years. How about that? Is that right? Do I need to play a little bit more?
No, it's gorgeous.
Well, good.
It's a beautiful song, isn't it?
Yeah. It is a beautiful song. And so eerie that, you know, on Mother Love, the last song they recorded together, as you say, that they lyrically, you know, they stitch back to specifically this song and that era of their lives, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, quite a lot of... there are lots of references back on Made in Heaven, including, I think I'm correct, every single song they ever played sped up.
Yes.
Yes.
Is that on Mother Love?
I think it is. It's like the end, and then there's like a baby crying at the end.
Yeah.
Backwards. Yeah.
Every single track that they've ever recorded all blasted into a little wall of noise. Yeah.
It's interesting this because I think this is originally Dusty Springfield recorded it, and you can hear Freddie's got his definite, you can hear it's Freddie, but it's almost like he's aping her voice a tiny amount, like just enough.
Slightly it's, tempered.
Yeah, it's really interesting how he can sort of flip into a slight amount of someone else's voice.
That's amazing. That's brilliant.
Here's a question for you all. What song would you most like to have heard Queen cover?
Oh man, that's another podcast entirely, isn't it?
I mean, I have an answer.
I did love it when they played Feel Like Making Love on the Paul Rodgers tour. I loved that. I thought that was fantastic. It just sounded amazing. I don't know, anything by Mika.
Maybe one to consider for next week.
Yeah,
we can
that's
all
a
think
great
about yes, choices.
Yeah.
I actually have an answer, and it's Heaven on Their Minds from Jesus Christ Superstar. I think Freddie would have absolutely smashed that. That first top A in Jesus. I'd have loved to have heard him sing that.
Just belt that out.
Yeah.
That's a great question. That is up there with some of your greatest facts, John. That is that's very, very good. So the last little track that we'll listen to round out this sort of Simon Says special is The Man from Manhattan, which was recorded a lot later, in August 1975. So Queen were well established by now, I would say. Obviously, they hadn't released Night at the Opera yet. But it appeared on the Ghost of a Smile album, actually. Freddie was playing the piano, doing backing vocals, and produced the song. Brian was playing guitar, and Eddie Howell was doing the lead vocals. But by this point, and I think it was eventually released in 1976, March 1976, as a single. But what's interesting about it is, by this point, it is essentially a Queen song, with the exception of Eddie Howell, who's not able to quite hit what Freddie would do with that track. But this is The Man from Manhattan by Eddie Howell.
Hey, the girl, do you trust me? Oh, I'm gonna tell you no lies. I'm gonna come clean, don't make a scene. I've been hiding behind a disguise. It's a satin, the lining is laid with lead.
I mean, how killer Queen can you get, actually?
Yeah.
What a track. It's a great track. I like it a lot, but it's so Queen. What do you think, guys?
Yeah.
I haven't heard that song for 25 years.
25 years?
Yeah, I've got it on CD, but there's a small portion of my CDs, maybe about 20 CDs, which didn't get imported into my iTunes, and that's one of them. I remember just seeing that cover there, that terrible cover where Freddie
look
looks
like
depressed.
They look like they're not speaking
to each other. It's such an odd image to choose. But I remember it. Crikey Moses. It's got a slightly Beatlesy vibe to it in places.
Yes. That's true. Mm. Yeah. Actually, a lot of the stuff we've listened to on this podcast, you can sort of feel those Beatles influences, as much as, you know, we've talked a lot about Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix, but there is a lot of Beatles sounds going through all of this. Inevitably, yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, descending bass chords and whatever. But yeah, there it is. I think that has now thoroughly covered as much as we could find of all the sort of stuff around the beginning of Queen, the genesis of Queen, stuff that we're looking at over series one. So,
Simon, one to round off one fact. Did Freddie join Smile, or did Smile disband and Brian and Roger form Queen with Freddie, although it wasn't called Queen at the time?
My understanding is Freddie said that he would sing for them as Smile, but he very quickly changed the name to Queen because he had such big plans. But I'm pretty sure they did a few gigs as Smile, And
so it's sort of Smile and Queen are the same timeline, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, on Wikipedia, where they have the sort of members' timelines with... You could add Smile to that. It's not like Smile ended and then 2 months later Freddie said to Brian and Roger, hey, we should start a band. It was sort of... It did overlap in that sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think if you want to draw, we could perhaps draw the line where it started is that moment where Tim and Brian jammed with Roger for the first time. I think that is perhaps where you would start the Queen timeline. And yeah, and as you say, Tim left, Freddie took over, and then Smile morphed into Queen.
A few podcasts ago, actually, Simon, you mentioned that your old teacher, David Cripps, played in the support act for, and they were billed as Smile, but when they turned up, they asked to be announced as Queen. So you could see that overlap starting to take place in an earlier anecdote.
Yeah, and they just played the Cavern Club, which, of course, was famous for, you know, where the Beatles, you know, played. And because of it, I believe that Queen asked for more money because they felt they were bigger because they played the Cavern Club. And they were told no.
Oh. Amazing. All right. Well, look, that is a lovely special. I think if you have a deep cut question or if there's stuff that we're talking about that you want more information about, you may find we'll devote an entire special to just your question. So thank you to all of you that wrote in and asked us to explain a little bit more about Smile. It gave us a lovely opportunity to look at their early stuff and just see how talented they were right from the off, which it's actually been a really enjoyable dive. So until next time, I'm going to say to you, please, please, if you have a question like that, email us queenpod@thequeenpodcast.com. That is the best way to get us information that you want us to get into, or you can drop us a line to tell us how much you love us at The Queen Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Also, obviously, please do like and review on whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on. If you do want to tell us how much you hate us, just do that by email. That would be great. That just leaves me to say a very fond farewell. Let's say goodbye to the guys from all the guys. Goodbye.
Bye.
Lots of editing for producer Giles to do. Good night.
This has been The Queen Pod, a Seven Seas Films production, edited and produced by me, Fergus March. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram and stay in touch by emailing queenpod@thequeenpodcast.com. Thanks for listening and see you next time.